Real information, good conversation, unabashedly Wisconsin. Up North News with Pat Kreitlow starts now.
Well, here we are, and good morning. Welcome to the State of Wisconsin Sense. It's Tuesday, September 20th, National Voter Registration Day. Not a registered voter yet. It's super easy. We'll try to talk you through the steps a little later. Coming up this morning, journalist Dan Schaefer has the latest Wisconsin political news that he's adding to his column, the recombobulation area. Hans Breitenmoser on the farm bill that should be discussed next year and what the priorities should be for Wisconsin farmers. Also, Queen Elizabeth is still dead. Just checking. Wanted to give you that update. Make sure Luke was paying attention. We got a half inch of rain here on Lake Wissota, but parts just east of here ended up getting a lot more, at least, you know, radar indicated. It sounds like some places got 4 to 6 inches of rain, maybe. And, you know, it formed right over Dunn and Chippewa counties about 2 o'clock in the morning. So that was a lot of fun. So I've kind of been more or less awake since then because it was loud. There was a lot of lightning in there. And like I said, some heavy rains at times. And, you know, we'll have to deal with it because it comes, you know, with a warm front that is only going to leave us with one more day of 80s, apparently. This might be it. I mean, we always talk about maybe getting a heat wave in October. And from time to time, it does happen, but don't count on it. Let's put it that way.
It's some pretty good timing though, because like this is right the end of summer. These are the last couple days of summer, and it almost makes sense that we've got our potential last day of 80 degree weather.
It's almost too perfect that, you know, the fall weather begins on the first day of fall. Did you ever see The Truman Show with Jim Carrey? I forget what year that movie came out.
I've always meant to watch it. I've always like, it's always like, oh, that looks like something that I would enjoy. And then
1998. I highly recommend it.
I was very young when that one came out. So it's on a list to watch, but I haven't got to it yet.
Oh no. Yeah. I would definitely say put it on a watch list because some days the things come together just too well. And you look up to see, am I in a simulation? Is this just a great big dome and they have hit the button just in time for the first day of autumn? You know, if a spotlight were to come crashing down, you know, from way up above, that would concern me, but that only happens in the movies, right? Here's hoping. Luke and I were comparing notes, and we, again, neither one of us are certifiably old, but we're getting there quickly. We were competing to see who was ready to call it a night first because of our new earlier hours here. And for us, it was 8:15 when Sherry and I kind of looked at each other, and we had this, you know, thing about you really shouldn't go to bed earlier than 9. Otherwise, you're going to wake up too early. But, you know, 8:15, we're like, we could go now. As it turns out, we made it to 8:45, but sure enough, like I said, been up since about 2:30, 3 o'clock, but that was Mother Nature's fault. Luke, meanwhile, anytime Luke stays up past 7 p.m., it's a miracle to me because of how early he has to get up.
Yeah, I've become pretty accustomed to having to, I just accept most evenings. Like if I want to do something with friends on the new schedule, I'm just like, okay, I'm going to be running on 6 hours of sleep max. Is usually what it comes down to, because I'll have friends that are like, oh, 9:30 is not too late, but by the time you get home, you get the coffee pot set to go, you get your routine done, everything like that, and you're actually in bed, I'm looking at like 6 hours. So yesterday, it was a pretty quiet night around our household, and right about 7:30, I had finished up dinner, I was sitting down for the second kickoff of Monday Night Football, which was really weird to have a doubleheader of Monday Night Football this early.
Yeah, but they always do on week one or the first week of Monday Night games.
Really?
Oh, yeah, first or second. Because, again, they're trying to get the viewers in there. But, at least you had the good sense to switch over to football. I stuck with the Brewers and, you know.
Well, I don't get the Brewers.
It was Max Scherzer.
I didn't have the option.
That's true. You don't have. You're not allowed to have Valley Sports, Mr. Cord Cutter over there. So you missed the what was supposed to be this great pitching duel between Corbin Burns and Max Scherzer. Well, I mean, Max Scherzer, yes, it's his first start since being injured, but he is an absolute machine. And he proved it last night with six perfect innings. Perfect. 18 Brewers up, 18 Brewers down. And then they pulled him, which was the, I don't think you could come up with a better insult for the Brewers. Like, you know what? You're not worth it to try to get a perfect game because we've got to save Scherzer for the postseason. That's actually the third time now this season that a pitcher has had a perfect game and been pulled. And of course, it is the big three. You know, Max Scherzer last night after 68 pitches, Justin Verlander last month, six perfect innings, and he's done. Clayton Kershaw earlier this season, seven perfect innings, and then they pulled him. And before that, it had never, ever happened in a Major League Baseball game where a pitcher had a perfect game and you pulled him, you know, at some point. But now everything's about the postseason. The postseason's a lot longer. You got to save those arms. So anyway, Brewer bats never did come to life and they lost to the Mets 7-2. 2.5 games back of the wild card now, 6:40 tonight and 1:10 tomorrow. Coming up next, Hans Breitenmoser joins us. And we will talk a bit about some of the work he was doing in Washington, D.C., getting set to lay out some priorities for Congress for next year for Wisconsin farmers. That's after this break. You're up north. Sounds peaceful like that for like the first half inch, and then after that it gets a little ridiculous. But hopefully not too many people got the kind of rain that would really hamper the work that they have to do. People like Hans Breitenmoser, who joins us from up in the Merrill area. Morning, how are you?
Good morning, Pat. I'm fine. How are you?
I'm good, thanks. You have had a whirlwind couple of days last week out in Washington, D.C. on behalf of the National Farmers Union. So we're going to talk a little bit about the priorities that Farmers Union members are seeking in the next farm bill. We'll talk a bit about the rain and the harvest and, you know, the climate and things like that. And more over the next little bit here. We're going to start for, you know, we want folks to really use these segments with Hans to kind of hear more about right now. Typically when you hear about farm news, farm markets, it seems like the only time you hear something, if you're not a farmer, is either when there's a disaster or when prices are super high or super low. And other than that, you probably take a lot of their work for granted. And we really want to show you and tell you more about the work that's done day to day and throughout the year. And not just the chores, but the policies. The people that you vote for help determine what kind of a life and lifestyle Wisconsin farmers have. So I want to start, Hans, before we even get to the trip. You were there on behalf of the National Farmers Union and Wisconsin Farmers Union. For folks that want to know more about that, they've maybe heard of Farmers Union. They've maybe heard of the Farm Bureau. I know there's one or two others. Can you tell us a bit more about Farmers Union?
Sure. Well, so Farmers Union's an organization that's been around for, I don't know, 130 years or something insane like that. It's been around for quite some time. And as one would imagine, there, you know, it came about when farmers were struggling to get fair prices for their products. And so like any other sort of organization or union or association, they decided that they would be stronger together and work together to make sure that the processors and retailers down the supply chain, you know, weren't gouging them. And also on the other end of the equation, right? So as far as farm inputs and purchasing things so that, you know, just basically sort of fair practices and transparency and that type of stuff is what that organization is built on. And every year they have a fly-in to Washington, D.C. They used to call it a train-in because this organization's longer, has been around longer than you know, commercial airline, you know, flights.
Yeah.
Every year we go to Washington to talk with our legislators and talk to the, you know, whatever current administration and bureaucrats about what our priorities are.
Now, I don't want to stir up any trouble here when I talk about the different groups, but it seems to the casual observer, what Farmers Union promotes is a bit more on the progressive side of things. And what we often hear coming out of farm bureaus, state or national, leans a little bit more conservative. Is that by design? Is that how things just kind of shook out? Is it based on geography or representation, or is it all just, did it all just kind of happen?
Well, I think to a certain extent, it just sort of happens. I mean, I can speak to Farmers Union probably more intelligently than I can speak about Farm Bureau. Both organizations represent people in rural areas, and both organizations, I think, are concerned about, rural economies and our farmers. But certainly we have sometimes different opinions on how to get, from point A to point B and what things are important. But what I felt with Farmers Union is, and why I felt like I found a home there, is that Farmers Union has historically has had a real good handle on the root causes of issues, rather than constantly focusing on symptoms. Let's get to the root of the matter. And it also is a very grassroots organization. So every year we have a convention that where we create our public policy positions and then go to Madison and Washington with those positions that came very much from the grassroots of the organization.
Yeah, if there's one thing I've learned as a city kid who A, married into a farm family, and then B, covered a lot of the farm crisis in the 1980s. They'll tell you can talk to 30 different farmers and get 30 different approaches to how something should be done, as can be said with lots of other groups. But still, it is important for as many people as possible to bring those voices together to kind of look for a consensus when looking into priorities. And so that's where we're going to shift attention now to your trip to Washington for Farmers Union. Let's again go back to basics and talk about a farm bill, something that, again, back in the day was like a almost like clockwork. Every 4 years, Congress would work on a massive farm bill that would cover everything from milk prices to school lunch programs to so many things. And if memory serves, it hasn't always been on that 4 year cycle, as circumstances have changed and political battles have heaved back and forth. What is the farm bill like these days?
Well, I think it's like so many other things these days, right? Because of politics being as polarized and screwed up as it is, it makes it more difficult for the farm bill to happen, and no different than any other legislation. We can go, from one end of society to the other and say, man, why did this used to be, fairly streamlined and now it's a cluster? And I think it really comes down to politics. But yeah, the farm bill is basically what directs USDA and generally farm policy. This is something that it's important for farmers and these farm organizations to have their voice heard in Washington, because as one can imagine, and what I learned, on a very sort of basic level when I went to Washington, D.C., this was my first fly-in, is that, these legislators and the administrative, the executive branch of the government, they're being just absolutely inundated by, all sorts of people with all sorts of ideas, not and certainly not just about ag. I mean, we live in a great big country with a lot of people and a lot of opinions and so forth. So standing outside these legislators' offices, waiting to get in and get through security and so forth, I mean, we were surrounded by, our little group was surrounded by all sorts of other associations and groups also waiting to get in to talk with legislators. So the demand on their time and their mental energy is just unbelievable.
I can relate, remembering a virtual parade of constituents and groups coming in, but every one of them was always appreciated because, again, that's what I refer to as small L lobbyists. lobbyists, not the capital L lobbyists, the ones in the very expensive suits or who are around Capitol buildings all the time. These are the folks from your district, from your state that are coming in and, you know, really kind of talking from the heart. One of the first things that's listed in the 2023 Farm Bill priorities material here does not surprise me that it's about strengthening the farm safety net. And that right away gets people to again, who are more casual observers, maybe thinking, you know, why are we always talking about price supports and a safety net for farmers? And so I know we're stating the obvious, but we can end up importing 100% of our TVs. We can import, you know, 100% of our airplanes, you know, whatever the case may be. Try being 100% reliant on your food. Your food supply is a totally different matter. And that is why we've got to be better to our farmers. And that includes a safety net. When you live in a place like the U.S. with, I hate to say it, folks, you can talk about inflation all day long. We got cheap food here compared to many other places in the world. And as a result, it's made it really hard for family farmers to stay as a family farm rather than sell out to a corporate interest. So having set that up, Hans, what kind of farm safety net are we talking about that's needed in the year 2023 when Congress takes up its next round of farm legislation?
Yeah, well, I think what's important to consider with the farm safety net and what Farmers Union, you know, is talking about when we go to Washington is it's not that average Joe and Jane Q farmer want handouts. I think largely we're looking for consistency in safety nets and price support type stuff, not so much in terms of we want to be subsidized all the time, but rather to have something in place that makes it more streamlined at the USDA. So when natural disasters happen, they're not constantly reacting and farmers are getting, you know, some sort of financial support, you know, a year or two after the fact. So what we're talking about there in terms of safety net is just the, sort of that streamlining of the process. But I think what's more important to remember in the far bigger picture in all this is that if we could get back to a point where we have more robust competition and less monopolizing of things, then suddenly these safety nets become less and less of an issue, right? I mean, if more of that food dollar that you spoke of, and you're correct, I mean, people, it is tough when you go to the grocery store and you see prices have gone up, but it is also just a fact that as a percentage of the average paycheck in the United States, we spend less on food than a lot of people in a lot of other countries. And that's good. And that's as it should be, but what we're talking about here is the supply chain and all the fingers that are reaching into that on the way and how consolidated some of these things have become. So when you talk about things like meat packing, for example, I mean, you know, 85% of the beef that's processed in this country is processed by four major companies. And that's perhaps on paper, that's not a monopoly, but it's close enough for it to have a huge impact on what the consumer pays and what the farmer gets. So when we talk about safety nets, I think, again, we have to back up, look at the bigger picture and say, why are prices pushed down at the farm gate? What causes that? And if the cause of that is just a lack of enforcement of, you know, antitrust legislation, then maybe we should refocus our priorities and make sure that those things are taken care of rather than constantly bailing out farmers who have their hands stuck out.
Yeah, it's a lot like what Brad Paff, the Democratic candidate for Congress in the 3rd Congressional District, was talking about on this very program just over a week ago, that when you have the possibility of more meat processors, small local meat processors, and we know them in Wisconsin, there are certain places that we like to stop at. We show up with a cooler and we load up because we know we're going to get a good product. It's going to be local. But they're not getting nearly enough assistance. And again, it's one thing to be a pro-business group, as a lot of our Republican friends are. But at some point, and I'm talking about monopolies and trusts, you have to be standing up for the little guy. You have to be standing up for the local folks in your district. And I know, Hans, the same thing has been said before about, you know, cheese and dairy, for example, you know, the number of, you know, big boys that are there. So this is just something that Congress has been asked for years and just hasn't taken seriously enough, right?
I think so. But again, I really feel like we would get more traction, you know, and Republicans and Democrats, I think, would work more together if the sort of the messaging was changed, and I'm not even saying it correctly, but just the sort of the idea. I mean, what we've got right now.
Hans, hold that thought. We're going to go to break, and I'm going to try to ask my question a little better, and then we'll continue our discussion with Hans Brighton Moser right after this. You're up north.
Real information, good conversation, unabashedly Wisconsin. You're listening to Up North News.
Coming up on Friday's show, Sean Fetteplace of Main Street Alliance, Wisconsin. If you'd like to get in touch with us, our phone number is 715-388-7155. And our email address is radio@upnorthnewswi.com. Hans Brighton Moser joins us from Lincoln County to talk about a recent trip to D.C. with Farmers Union folks and talking about priorities that Congress should take up in the new year once these elections are passed. Before we went to break, I was trying rather clumsily to ask about monopoly and competition concerns for farmers. And we've talked about meat packing, and I was trying to explore if there are other particular areas where that is also a large concern. Is meat packing the biggest one, or between dairy and vegetables and everything else? Are there also competition concerns?
Yeah, there sure are, Pat. And one of the things that was interesting going out to D.C. was not only meeting with legislators and folks from USDA, but was also listening to the concerns of other farmers. So out west, for example, out in the sort of the grain states, those guys are really having some issues with rail monopolies and how that impacts their operations. They're hundreds of miles away from anything, and rail is what they use to get their crops from point A to point B. And as the rail has become more monopolized, guys like Warren Buffett, God love them, but they're always looking at that bottom line. And if they don't see any money in sticking money into that infrastructure, these guys, end up suffering. These producers end up suffering. They talked about how they used to be able to, order 20 train cars, and now they're forced to order 50. Otherwise the train won't talk to them. And then how they're penalized by, not getting their commodity on the train so the train can move again. But if their train cars show up a week later than what they were supposed to, there's no, compensation the other way around. It forces farmers to have more grain storage. It forces these elevators to get larger. It forces guys to use plastic to store their grain temporarily, which causes more waste. It forces them to sometimes put it on the ground, which causes more shrink. So that was just another example of how how monopolies play a part. And one thing that was fascinating there too was, this was not a room full of flaming liberals, but as these sort of conservative guys were talking about the issues with rail and understood how important good old fashioned competition is, I was thinking, maybe we should nationalize the rail lines. Well, I wasn't going to go there because I thought I'd get booed right out of the audience. Well, I'll be damned if one of these guys didn't stand up and say exactly what I was thinking. Maybe we ought to nationalize the rail lines. And given the crowd, I was like, holy smokes, wow, he actually went there. But it does make you think about competition. And it is whether it's ag or whatever, but ag is my world. And if ultimately we need a place where we've got good old fashioned competition, and when you don't have that, it just doesn't agree more.
And again, I'm going back 15 years, to being in the legislature, but frustrations with the railroads then, because railroads, again, there's only a few of them. They're very huge, and they are notoriously unresponsive. They couldn't care. They feel like they are untouchable by mm-hmm. Congress and by state legislatures. And it's rather depressing to see that things just haven't changed in that area. So why wouldn't people be talking about drastic action?
Right. Yeah. And I think that's the thing. I mean, right. You get to a certain point where you almost become sort of radicalized and you're willing to, go someplace where you otherwise normally wouldn't. But I think I think there's ways of fixing that. It just takes the political will to do so. And then once again, we're back to following the money and who's greasing these politicians. But competition in that world, competition in the retail grocery world, we can beat up on Walmart, but you consolidate that much of a market into the hands of that few of people, and it's going to have a negative impact on both producers and consumers. It just is. There's enough of these dollars to go around. They're just not being, allocated very well, I think.
Right. And again, we don't have to go back all the way to the roots of Reaganomics, but I certainly remember, clear as a bell, hearing back in the day that, if we have deregulation, then we'll have more competition somehow. And it turns out all the people that warned, if you go with, too much deregulation, you're going to get more consolidation, were proven absolutely correct. I mean,
I think so. I think there's just a certain sort of common sense rules of the road to make sure. And that should be a priority for all of our legislators, regardless if they're Republicans or Democrats. I mean, when we're talking about food, we're talking about national security. I mean, when you've got four companies processing that much of our beef and our poultry and our pork, and that is controlled by companies who aren't even headquartered in the United States, that should worry us. That should make us, a little concerned. Another thing that Farmers Union was talking about when we were in D.C. was foreign ownership of land. There are greater and greater tracts of farmland that are being bought up by the Chinese. And again, it's great to have a good relationship with China as far as trade and so forth and so on. But when it comes to the land that produces our food, that to me seems like a national security concern. And it also speaks to just, our local economies and our local governments and how they function. People locally have skin in the game. People who, if large tracts of ag land in your community are owned by some foreign or even a domestic conglomerate that's on Wall Street, that's not going to work as well when it comes to your school systems and your roads as if it's, all the farmers up and down the road owning that ground.
Well, if that just doesn't stick out when you talk about foreign ownership of farmland. So what we're saying is that it's very easy for money to come across the border and have an impact on farming. And yet, as Ruth Conniff told us a couple of weeks back, so many dairy operations in Wisconsin have to rely on undocumented immigrants because you can't get common sense legal immigration reform so that these folks can get at least some kind of agricultural visa. Right now, for those of you who missed that show, Ruth pointed out the only agricultural visas out there are for like harvest time. They're temporary, but you milk cows year round. And so without that immigration reform, all those people coming in to help our farmers are always doing so, with the threat of arrest. But apparently foreign money has no problem getting across the border and affecting our farms.
Well, money talks and BS walks, I guess.
That's right.
That's how that system works.
Yeah. Let's turn now to a couple of the other priorities here, conservation being the big one. And again, one of the things I've learned from, covering farmers throughout the years, the ones who are amazingly good stewards of the land, because good land gives you good production. And that also means, knowing how to use it, whether it's rotating crops, not growing something in a certain area, and preventing, runoff, not just of soil, but of chemicals into the area. But you also hear from a lot of small producers, they'd like to do more of these conservation efforts, but you're already operating on a paper thin margin as it is. So if government wants to make that a priority, taking care of our natural resources, that's got to be a priority in the Farm Bill next year too.
Yeah, I think so. And it historically it has. NRCS has been a good partner for us here on the farm. You know, some farmers are kind of allergic to anything that has to do with, you know, dealing with any kind of bureaucrats. But for the most part, you know, I think it's still important for NRCS, which is...
Hold on, what's NRCS?
So National Resource Conservation Service. So it's part of the USDA, but that focuses on natural resources.
Okay.
And so there's been cost share dollars, but there's also been a lot of education because... we need to know what best practices are, you know, when we're talking about cover crops and such things. And it's good to have that technical advice as well. But I think you're right. And one of the things that's interesting too, in this sort of more recently here with fertilizer prices going up, because of the issues between, you know, with the Russian invasion of Ukraine and so forth, that's driven fertilizer prices up. The healthier that our soils are and the more productive they're going to be, the less reliant we are on commercial fertilizer. But it does come down to understanding crop rotations and so forth. And the other exciting thing that's happening there is that we know that out in, you know, the rural parts of our country and certainly our state, that's where some of this climate mitigation is going to happen. I mean, we have the ability to sequester carbon. So farmers want to be a partner in that and, you know, and should, you know, should be able to do all right with it as well and make sure that doesn't end up being another system where extraction of wealth happens.
Can you tell folks a bit more about the impact of Russia's invasion of Ukraine? We knew it as a kind of a breadbasket for that part of the world, but as a result, you know, you impact such an agricultural reliant country like that. The ripples go globally, don't they?
Absolutely. I mean, we're in such a global market regardless, and certainly ag is not immune to that. It's very, very global. And the United States has been such a big player for so many years, so that, you know, we're impacted because we rely on foreign markets for some of our commodities that we sell. Those markets are impacted when large players like Russia and Ukraine have an issue like, you know, a war. And just geographically, because of where Ukraine is located and because of who Ukraine has fed historically, that has had an impact on us. It has had, I think it's, you know, helped push commodity prices up for our farmers, but it's also pushed fertilizer prices up as well. So, and I think just getting back to sort of a human standpoint, you know, we've seen in our ag publications, the AgriView and such things, magazines and newspapers that we get, you know, devastation in Ukraine, bombed out tractors and, you know, farmsteads that have been burnt to the ground and so forth. And, you know, it's interesting for a farmer because I think, you know, when we watch the news or, you know, we see, you know, the devastation in cities and we see military equipment destroyed and all that human tragedy. But I was surprised how it struck me at a different level to see a farm tractor that was burnt up, you know, and that type of thing, because it's when you're a farmer and that's your world, you know, you're looking at those images and saying, wow, that looks like my farm. And it was attacked. You know, it's just terrible.
It is. It's just such a tragedy. And I think far too often, certain people just treat it as some kind of a geopolitical chessboard and forget the real lives and livelihoods in there. All right, let's come all the way back home here. And I'm speaking just from very personal experience. The cornfield across the street has never looked better. Been a magnificent year. It's tall. It's healthy. What's your impression? We're not going to do the exact farm markets for you every 2 weeks, but what's your impression of how are things looking for harvest time this year?
Pretty good, I think. Pretty good. Last year we had amazing corn yields and bean yields. This year I think they're going to be very good. I mean, the jury's still out. I talked to a producer down in the southern part of the state where, you know, they didn't get some rain And so he was concerned that while his corn looked good from far away when he went in the cornfields, the cobs weren't that great just because of pollination and moisture at the right time. So the weird thing is that it is very, very spotty. So you'll have very good places and, you know, some places not so good. But in our immediate area here in north central Wisconsin, I think for the most part, the crops look pretty good. And we'll see what the weather does here. But I'm thinking that maybe by the end of next week, we need to start thinking about chopping some corn. So
there we go. And some very familiar activity will be seen out there well into a lot of the evenings. Hans, it's great to talk to you as always. Thanks for giving us the update on everything out there in Washington and closer to home. And we'll talk to you in a couple of weeks again.
Great. Thanks a lot, Pat. Take care.
All right. Thank you. Talk to you later. We will take a break. We'll wrap up this hour's conversation. But first, a reminder that if you want our daily newsletter, you can sign up for it at upnorthnewswi.com. Just click newsletter up in the top banner. We'll be back in a bit. You're up north. Circus music can only mean one thing. It's time to talk about Michael Gableman, everybody's favorite fake inspector of elections and otherwise driver of a clown car. The clown car was seen in the Racine area on Monday as Gableman, the disgraced former state Supreme Court justice and then disgraced former investigator who was fired by Robin Voss as being an embarrassment to Wisconsin, showed up in court to defend a man who has admitted to voter fraud. So again, Gableman, the man who spent over $1 million of your money to look for voter fraud that didn't exist and didn't find any voter fraud, was in court helping defend a man who admitted to committing voter fraud as a way to prove that voter fraud could exist, but only if you actually commit it, as only he did. He, Harry Waite, the right-wing activist from the Racine County area. It would be enough if it was just that, but of course there's more with Gableman. There's always more. We mentioned last week about how a woman had was taping video of him at a dinner in Appleton. And it turns out his remarks there was more to it than just what he was discussing with Lauren Windsor up on stage. You recall we played the video of that encounter where Lauren Windsor asked Gableman a question, a very basic question. Why haven't you released documents that a judge demanded as part of a lawsuit against Gableman in an open records case and prove that you haven't been mishandling public records? Gableman hasn't been able to do that. It's why he was found in contempt of court. Lauren Windsor asked a basic question. Why don't you produce those documents? Gableman gave a very word salad answer and was very, you know, boisterous in the process.
Not only boisterous, but also very like, oh, nobody on the left would treat me with this amount of respect. It was like very much like he wanted credit for not being a total ass. I don't know.
Yes. Like, and yet, as you'll find out, he was deciding yesterday after the court appearance to be an ass. But to get back to the dinner remarks, no, actually, I'm going to end with the dinner remarks, more from that dinner that Lauren Windsor was covering. Let's stick with the thing yesterday with Harry Waite. Again, the man who has admitted to fraudulently obtaining the absentee ballots of other people without their permission. And there was Gableman saying he was there just for the day because Harry Waite did not have a lawyer to represent him yet. And so Gableman was kind of a legal advisor. And did I send you the audio of his interaction with a reporter after that court case yesterday?
You did not, but I, in anticipation of this segment, pulled it up anyway. So we have it with Matt Smith from WISN over in Milwaukee. Is that what you would have sent me? I'm not. This is the one I saw. So
we ever met Dionne Warwick? Because I swear when she was doing the Psychic Friends Network commercials back in the day, she meant us. There's just that connection there. So yeah, let's hear what Michael Gableman, who was crowing over a week ago about how nice he was treating Lauren Windsor. Let's see how he treated this Milwaukee Journal or this Milwaukee TV reporter. That's it. That's where he left it. Was insulting the reporter and saying, "Oh, you ought to go into door-to-door sales." You know, again, he's not capable of just talking to somebody politely. There is nothing in his track record that indicates that. He's got to be, you know, a horse's butt to everybody. But when it comes to his rhetoric at that same dinner where he had that interaction with Lauren Windsor, he then gave his prepared remarks. I don't know if they were prepared or off the cuff, but he says, quote, "For the first time in my life, I am beginning to wonder if America's best days are behind us." And he says, he talks about how comfortable Americans have become. "Our comfort is holding us back from taking action that is necessary," Gableman said at this Appleton dinner on September 9th. "The greatest challenge of our poor in this country is not a lack of food. It's obesity. It's a beautiful world, but it's that very comfort that is keeping us from what our founders knew to be the only way to keep an honest government, which is revolution. Thomas Jefferson said that the tree of liberty must be watered by the blood of revolution in every generation, and I just don't think that's going to happen." Folks, it is all I can do to keep from raising my voice too high when I hear anybody invoking the whole Thomas Jefferson quote about the tree of liberty being watered by the blood of patriots from time to time, because if it doesn't make you think of Timothy McVeigh and Oklahoma City and how that quote was part of his justification for blowing up 168 Americans, including babies, in a daycare center, you would not understand why anybody would use that quote ever again, much less continue to use it to, as he does right here, advocate for revolution. And let's look at the sentence before that. "The greatest challenge of our poor in this country is not a lack of food. It's obesity." Let me tell you something, you very large failure of an investigator. You have a problem with obesity. That much is true. But there are plenty of people in this country where lack of food is exactly the problem. They are not comfortable. They're not comfortable at all. And instead of getting fed or supported by people like you, you're taking away their right to vote. You're making it more difficult for them to participate in democracy. You're making it more difficult for them to get a school lunch without feeling shame. There's a lot more that Michael Gableman and others could be doing in the areas of helping people attain comfort, rather than claiming that there is so much comfort that there needs to be a revolution and that the blood of patriots must be shed. It's more than disgusting. In light of the way that that has been used by domestic terrorists in this country, fellow Americans who want to cause violent revolution, it is utterly disqualifying. And you'd like to think that no other place in this state would invite Michael Gableman back to give remarks anything like that. And yet, sadly, it probably will happen, but that's fine. We'll just call it out every single time. Dan Schaefer from the Recombobulation Area is coming up next. You're up north.